You're listening to episode 9 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order. It's my show about GNU and Linux and Unix and all kinds of geeky things. So if you are in the mood for really, really technical stuff and some mildly technical stuff and also some musing about technical stuff without really being sure about anything, then this is the show for you. So let's sit back and get it started with some listener feedback. I'm not making a promise, but this could be something that I could try to start getting more into, and that is to review the past 2 weeks worth of listener feedback, such as it is. I mean, I don't get all that much. I've only got, 30 listeners? But it could be something that I could do. Again, no promises. More than likely, I'll forget that I even said this to you by the next show, but it could be something. And let me know if you think that's a good idea, a bad idea, or if you're totally indifferent. It's fine. I don't really care that much, but I mean, if you like it and if you appreciate sort of hearing back from other listeners and kind of having that discourse, then do let me know and I will make an effort to remember to do that. This one is particularly easy to remember because it's direct feedback about something that I said, well, really two things that I said on the previous episode, which was an episode full of listener feedback, and it comes from Jonathan, or a Jonathan. It's not the Jonathan that I often refer to being Jonathan Nadeau. This is a different Jonathan, and he says that, well, first of all, that he appreciated the episode. Thank you very much, Jonathan. And he said that he thought it was odd that I would have touted the ability to move files from external media to your local hard drive as like a big feature that would be unique to KDE. So first of all, I should say that it wasn't so much that I was trying to tout it as a unique feature as much as I guess me not knowing that it wasn't a unique feature. Quite honestly, quite literally, KDE was the first file manager I've ever used that actually moved files in that way. I have literally not seen that in any other file manager to my knowledge. Now that doesn't obviously ever mean that it doesn't exist. It's just I didn't know about it, which kind of surprised me that it would be so prevalent, and I'd never heard of it before until KDE. Turns out I was totally wrong, and lots of file managers do it. Jonathan mentions GNOME, and I tried that out the other day, and sure enough, it worked like a charm. You click and drag and hold shift key and then drop, and it moves the file. I even tried it on another operating system that I have immediate access to here at the place where I work, and it even does it on there. And that was really surprising to me because I thought I knew every trick possible on that particular OS because I was what they call a power user on that OS. So I really thought I knew every single trick. Well, it's not entirely true. It was a different keyboard shortcut, but the same principle did apply. My only thought is that maybe I did know it at one point and then forgot it because I didn't ever use it, which is quite possible because I know a lot of weird tricks on a lot of different systems, but if I don't use something, I forget it. And when I was using my old OS, there were a lot of really probably helpful and handy tricks that I probably did learn, and I wasn't doing all that much work on that platform, whereas on Linux, the amount of actual productive stuff that I get done on a computer has just gone up so exponentially that I've started to actually use these little tricks. All of that aside, what I really like, and I've mentioned this I think either in the previous episode or my rave review of GNOME or something, I don't really remember, GNOME 3, don't really remember where I said this, but I do remember saying it, and that is that those little secret tips that people propagate sort of on this grassroots level, you know, where you find out about a trick because you know a friend who's been using the operating system 1 year longer than you, so they pass on a tip to you, and then you pass that one on to someone else, and then someone else passes one on to you, and it's a secret code and secret society that you get to be involved in. The excited, giddy OS user in me, you know, the geek who loves new stuff, loves to try new applications and all that other stuff, that part of me loves that kind of thing. I really do. I love it that you don't know how to shut down GNOME 3 without holding or without going out to the login screen unless you hit the secret key of Alt to get your shutdown menu in that menu. It's the stupidest design choice ever, right? And yet I love it because it's just like, hey, look how cool I am. I know how to shut down without going out to my GDM screen. I like that sort of thing. I'm a sucker for that. I'm sorry. The pragmatist in me, however, is completely opposed to that and would point out that the reason I knew how to move a file in the KDE interface is because when you drag a file from one Dolphin window to another, or even from one Conqueror to another before Dolphin, and you haven't defined any default action, it prompts you with a little pop-up menu. You can copy by holding the control key. You can move with the shift key. You can cancel this operation with the escape key. I mean, it tells you right there. It's so obvious, and no other file manager that I've used has ever done that for me. So everything else, you kind of stumble your way through. I'm not saying one way is right. I'm not saying one way is wrong. I obviously really actually like both, and it's just kind of interesting to notice how process of discovery occurs in our desktop environment. And anyway, the point is, for this tip, I have Jonathan to thank. So thank you again, Jonathan. The other thing Jonathan said was about fetch mail. And you'll recall, well, first of all, he says that fetch mail is capable of doing both IMAP and POP3. That's great to know. I figured it did, or was, I just could not remember off the top of my head whether I've ever used fetch mail with IMAP. I don't think I have, but anyway, it's possible, so very good to know. The other thing that he said about fetch mail was that the default behavior of fetch mail is to grab the email and dump it into the mail spool of your system. Take it from Jonathan, I guess. He's got a fancy sounding email, so he might really know what he's talking about. Take it from him that that's what you're supposed to be doing. But yeah, people who understand email, they amaze me. I mean, it's such a strangely complex system. And I know there are some people who are anti-email now, and they're like, oh, it's such an inefficient system, people need to get rid of it, we should all be microblogging, which I think is nonsense. But I will say that, yeah, email is a complex system, at least in my humble opinion. Maybe some people, it's completely natural. To me, it seems pretty complex. But if you think about it, what we ask of email is also a tall order. It's not like it's an overcomplex system for something very simple. If it was literally, okay, let's dump some email on a remote server and grab it to a computer on the other end, I can kind of see how that could be simplified, really, really simplified. Like literally, okay, SCP, all, you know, this inbox file from one server to another and delete it after you're finished. That could be it. But obviously that's not what any of us really want, right? We want our email to be available on this remote server from all of our different devices. We want it to always be aware that we've responded to a certain email message or that we haven't responded to another one. We ask a lot of email. So the fact that it's complex, I think, is not just for fun. It seems to need to be that way. So thank you very much, Jonathan, for all the good information, both about fetch mail and about the file manager tricks. That was really interesting to learn, actually. Thank you for the feedback. So let's see, any other feedback? Yes, actually there was some feedback from a guy named Raven debating on what exciting new distribution he was going to try next. And he was talking about this interesting remix or something called Viper. V-I-P-E-R-R, which is like Fedora and OpenBox. Sounds cool to me, although, as I've said before, I'm more of a Fluxbox kind of person, just because that was the one that I learned. So editing all my key files and menu files is just second nature. I don't even have to think about it, whereas OpenBox, I'd have to actually learn a new way of modifying my environment. So Fluxbox for me. But, and I mean, typically what I do, I don't really need remixes. I just, if I'm going to install Fedora and want to run Fluxbox, I just install Fedora and then throw Fluxbox on it. I mean, nothing's wrong with the remixes, but I don't really follow them that well, or that often. And so Fedora, Sabayon, Torox, T-O-O-R-O-X, and Salix OS. Interesting stuff. All interesting distributions. Well, I guess I don't really know what Torox is, but hard choice as always. I think he ended up going with Salix. Haven't heard back from him yet in terms of how that's working out for him, but it's kind of cool to hear someone trying out something Slackware-based. I know it's not Slackware, and I did remind him of that, but Slackware-based. And I've only heard good things about Salix. So, and actually, because he emailed me, I tried Zenwalk, the latest Zenwalk, and it is, every time I use one of those Slackware derivatives, it really does. It just really impresses me how clean and great Slackware is. Christian emailed me asking about hardware for audio, like what's compatible with Linux out of the box, that kind of thing. I'm not much of a hardware person, to be honest. I don't have like a studio. I don't really require that much on the outboard side. So, I mean, it's kind of like one of the big advantages of the music industry right now, right, is that you don't have to invest in a bunch of hardware, in theory. I mean, the good news is that if it's interfacing with a computer, these days, almost everything is USB-based, and it tends to just kind of work. You plug it into your USB port, and it recognizes that something's plugged into it, and whatever it is, whether it's a multi-input type of thing, like an analog-to-digital converter or whatever, it just works. It comes in as an audio input, and you're good to go. Mixing desks, I know a lot less about because, again, I don't have them. Heard a lot of great things about Harrison mixing desks, so if you're looking, then check into that. Other than that, I don't really know what else there is out there, so not much help on that side of things. And, of course, anytime anyone has any question about audio, hardware, software, whatever, the best place you can go is Open Musicians Podcast. Just go to their IRC channel, talk to them. They live this stuff day in, day out. Some of them are professional mixers or engineers or whatever. Some of them, you know, professional musicians, every possible aspect of the music business, well, production side and performance side is represented in that channel. So talk to them. Obviously take their advice with a grain of salt. I mean, they're probably right, but some of them are, you know, super audiophile snobs, or some of them are just like, eh, who cares as long as you get some sound. You know, they're just people. They have difference of opinions. But in terms of the hard and cold facts of, hey, does this work with Linux, or what's the theory behind this plugin or this kind of effect, that's the place to go. They're really, really well informed, and they have just a lot of practical experience. So use that as a resource. That's it for the listener feedback. I've been doing a lot of backing up lately. I've actually always been pretty good at backing up anyway. Lately, I've been doing a lot of it for other people, and it was, you know, traditionally I've used rsync, almost always rsync scripts. Sometimes they're even put on a cron job schedule. Lately, I've needed something that would be more user-facing, so I've been playing around with Backup PC, which a guy from IRC, Vulcan Writer, and actually Lord Drakenblut as well, both told me about. Been playing around with that. Been impressed. That's not what I'm going to talk about right now, though. And I should. I will probably do, like, a Backup PC segment at some point, because the setup for that thing is non-trivial, believe me. In fact, it's downright painful in many different ways. It's got so many steps to it, it's absurd. In fact, it might even be patentedly absurd. They might have actually put a patent on the absurdity involved with setting this thing up. I'm not saying it's bad or wrong. I understand that what you're designing here is an industry-strength, enterprise-ready backup solution that really, really works. So I understand that there's a lot of configuration involved, but let me tell you, it is intense. Anyway, that's, again, not what this segment is on. This is more about what you are backing up and how you know what you want to back up and ultimately where all that stuff goes in this system. This is kind of something that started, well, it's been an issue for me ever since I've started backing up, you know, way back when. It's been something that's kind of been nagging me lately, and I think it's been more noticeable for me because I've been doing so much backing up and really thinking about how things need to get backed up, all that other good stuff. And it's a question of redundancy in a bad way, meaning you've got data, and it's important data. And maybe you have this data across your systems. So if you start backing up that same data, then you're just eating up space, you're eating up time that it takes to transfer that stuff, that kind of data. So for me, personally, it would be a folder of fonts, a folder of brushes, a folder of sound fonts, some media clips that I have backed up anyway on the drive from which it comes anyway. You know, if it's a production I'm talking about, like video clips that I'm editing, it's been backed up because that's the editing workflow, right? You shoot, you take your SD card, you dump it onto the drive, that becomes your negative, and then you make a work print from that, as it were, so you're just duplicating that data. You don't need to duplicate that stuff again. This is your work print. You don't need the media. You can always go back to the negatives, as it were, the source material. If you lose the source, all you really need from that are your edit decisions, you know, which are what, like a 2 megabyte file, 5 megabyte file at the most. So there's a lot of bad redundancy that you want to avoid. Obviously, it could be argued completely validly that there's no such thing as too much redundancy when you're backing up. I totally understand that. But know that I'm not talking about that. For me, in this situation, there is such a a thing as bad redundancy, because I do have limited hard drive space, so I don't need to back up certain folders a million times. I just can't do that. So what I've decided, well, two methods of getting around. Three methods. The first method is the one that I've been doing up until very recently, which is just to keep a list of excludes for rsync to look at, and you include the exclude from flag in your rsync command, give it that file that you want it to look at for everything that it should not back up or synchronize, and that works pretty well. It works really well. The disadvantage to that one is that when I would add something to my hard drive, you know, I'd copy something that I want to have on that computer, without having an external drive or whatever available, then you would have to go in and edit that excludes file. So it kind of turns into this, okay, so I want this media off of this drive so that I can use it during this project. Therefore, I know I have it backed up on that drive. I really don't need to back it up here. So now not only do I have to go get that hard drive, load the media onto my normal drive, I also have to go to that excludes file and remember to add this folder or this file, whatever, into that excludes file. It's not going to happen, especially while you're working on some kind of artistic or time-sensitive project. You're just not going to take the time to add it to your excludes file. That's what I've found. So another way that I've done it, since in addition to doing a lot of backing up myself, I've been doing backup for multiple users. One of the things that I kind of got into the habit of doing was placing a lot of those artistic source files into a /home/shared file, and then create a group or have a group that you can give permission to write and read from that shared folder. So it's just kind of a normal shared folder, really, that happens to be on your hard drive. I put it in /home/shared because that's easy for other users to understand how to get there. I have found it's familiar to them. It's something that they can kind of understand. Home shared becomes this external folder that users can utilize by writing to and also reading from for different reasons, whether it's sharing files between them or whether it's reading in art sources that they need to use on some kind of project, or a variety of projects, possibly. So that's been pretty good. And that's really actually been the public-facing kind of way of doing it so far. I've been utilizing that for the people I've been working with who maybe aren't 100% familiar with Linux, but are pretty smart enough to use Linux, apparently. So it's kind of a convenient way to share files, and it's been working out really well. From my own personal multiple systems, because I do have a couple of computers that I use on a fairly regular basis, the system that I've come up with is placing things in /user/local/share. That's been working really well for me, and I've really actually enjoyed it, because it's gotten to feel a little bit more like my own personal distribution, which is what user local share is kind of for, something that I, as the sort of system designer, am adding to the proper Unix system, but it's something that I want people to be able to read from. And it's been really, really useful, actually, again, just really on my own personal systems. So I put all of my multimedia sprint stuff that I use on a daily basis, which is a lot of it, in there, in user local share. So when I need a new sound font, or I need to point QTractor to a sound font, rather, I know where to point it. When I want to point Blender to some kind of font to use, I know where that is. When I want to install a new font, I know where to go get it from. A new brush, I know exactly where it is. I also, as ridiculous as this seems, I put, like, music and movies there, because these are movies and music that I have backed up on an external file anyway, external hard drive anyway, but I know myself, and I know that if I'm working, if I'm writing some article or something, I'm going to want such and such an album to be playing in the background. So I'm going to want that file, that music, that album to be available. And there are just a couple of, like, I guess you'd call them comfort albums and movies that I like to have. You know, Evil Dead, the trilogy. I have to have that on every computer because I'm going to want that playing in the background while I work on some other task. It's a weird thing I have. Day the Earth Stood Still. You know, just the movies, like those movies that you just put on in the background, you know, those are the ones that I have to have on my computers, and I get annoyed if they're not there. So they go into user local share. Because when I write my rsync script, I don't want to have to exclude them. I don't want to have to think about them. I don't want to have to really consider them as part of my data. They're something that I just like to have on all of my computers. So yes, if Slacker Media were ever to go out as a a proper distribution, which, don't worry, it would never do that, but if it was going to, yes, it would ship with the Evil Dead trilogy, The Day the Earth Stood Still, probably a couple of other movies that I'm not thinking of, multimedia art kit, and a couple of albums, all in user local shared. It would be a huge download for that reason, and I do apologize for that. But anyway, that's the feel of it, you know, it's like my personal distribution, I've got all the stuff that I need on a daily basis, they're in user local shared, in different folders, and I don't have to write that into my rsync script. They don't have to be excluded from anything, because they're not being backed up, because I know that I have their master copies on some external drive that I don't want to carry around with me all the time, or go grab and plug into this computer every time I'm doing anything. So it's really, really handy. So do let me know of your own personal backup schemes. I would love to hear about it. And with that, I think it's time for a coffee break. If you've been a long-time listener of New World Order, you know that it's tradition to take a coffee break around the middle of the show. So if you're new, just it won't take long to get used to this. Just go get yourself a cup of coffee, sit down and relax, and we'll continue the show. Okay, I hope everyone got their cup of coffee, because we've still got half the show to go. If you're new, believe me, this is normal. This is what you have to do. And if you're not drinking coffee right now, I'd like for you to be respectful and just turn off the show. Go ahead, turn it off. Oh, I'm kidding. You can stay. But next time, bring your coffee. Come prepared. Now let's talk a little bit about how you organize your data that you probably do back up or should be backing up. And this is something that I kind of cheated and wrote a little blog about on Ogcast Planet, Unstable blog. So I'm not going to go on and on about it here because I don't want to duplicate content too much, but I think it's kind of apropos to sort of the feel of some of this episode. It's been a habit, I gather, recently, although I have to admit I haven't really been around the Linux scene all that long to be a really accurate judge of it. But I know that when I got introduced to Linux via Slackware, you go in and you do user add or add user, whichever you prefer, and you set up your user account, and it creates a folder, if you've told it to, creates a folder as /home/clatu or whatever your username is, and that's it. You sign in as your account, and there's your user directory that you sort of, that's your default environment or whatever, and that's it. You know, you make folders for yourself, directories that you think are logical and that would be useful to you. Lately, however, a lot of distributions, and again, I don't know what lately means, but I have noticed that some distributions have been doing the whole, hi, here's your home folder, here's a desktop folder, here's a documents folder, here's a movies folder, here's a music folder, here's a sites folder, and here's a public folder. And there are some variations on those, but that's kind of, that's the idea, right? They give you some predefined folders. Some of them don't make a whole lot of sense, like the whole desktop folder. I never understood that one. It's a folder that is also reflected on your screen. And I've never seen a noob who uses, or who understands fully why those two things exist at the same time. Why they get two different views of the same content. They never seem to be able to wrap their mind around that. So I don't quite understand the point there. But anyway, I guess I understand the point because it does exist. But and I guess my preconceived notion is that non-noobs don't use desktops, but that's, I'm sure, not true. So, okay, I get it anyway. Point being, these predefined folders, for me, are a little bit annoying, actually, because I don't really see how they fit into really anyone's categories of content, but especially I don't understand how they could possibly hope to ever fit everyone's way of modifying data. And they get on my nerves for a couple of reasons. One being that I don't really get, I don't name my files the same way that they do. So these folders are always capitalized. I never capitalize the first letter of any file. Never. Ever, ever, ever. I'm always doing lowercase and then camel case afterwards. So that always throws the view of my content off for me, and that annoys me. Other than that, I've got a completely different way of classifying the data that I do have on my computer. I don't see what documents or movies or music means. You know, like a music folder, does that contain music that I am using in something that I am creating, like a podcast episode or an album or something? Or does it contain music that I'm going to be listening to for fun? You know, music that has been released on the internet that I have downloaded and that I want to listen to have a good time. Does movies or videos, you know, what is that? What does that contain? Videos that I've shot, videos of someone else's that I'm editing for them, videos that, again, that it's a movie that I want to, that I've ripped from a DVD and that I want to view as I work. What is that stuff? And the whole idea of dumping a bunch of stuff into a folder, like the downloads folder from Firefox, I think that's what actually enforces that one. That's just never been a good idea to me. I know that there are some very big companies out there who are swearing that that's how things are going to have to go. We all have to just dump our data into a big folder called Data, My Stuff. And we find it not by knowing where it is. We don't care where it lives on our computer. We just want to search for it, and that's how we look at our data. That's fine for you if you like it, but not everyone works that way. So I don't really approve of that idea at all. And I always set my Firefox to ask me, where do you want this file to go? Don't just dump it into download, because you know you're not going to go into downloads and sort through that stuff. There's going to be a copy of every single thing you've ever downloaded in Firefox in your downloads folder forever, and you're backing that up. So have fun with that. So less confrontationally, I should say that what I typically do is delete all of those folders. I think it's documents and desktop that certain distributions literally don't let me delete, if memory serves. They just keep being regenerated. So those sometimes get perpetuated. But the other ones go away. And I organize it differently, such as Amarok, an Amarok folder, because originally that's the application that I was using when I was coming up with this schema. But either way, Amarok seems to describe perfectly for me that this is music that needs to be opened and listened to in a music player. It doesn't have to be Amarok, obviously. You could call it anything. Lately, I've been calling it albums, which works. So then there's an audio folder, which is the music and the audio stuff that I am working on myself. It's audio files, but it's not stuff you're going to sit down and listen to. It's stuff that you're working with. There's, of course, the bin folder, BIN, for the binaries and scripts and things like that that I run on my system, that I create myself or that I download and use a lot. There's cinema, which is the stuff that, you know, the movies that I like to watch. And usually, actually, that goes into user local share now. So that's not being created as often anymore. But there is a cinema folder now in user local share. There's code, which is my own little coding projects, such as they are. There's docs, which is documents. Fewer characters than documents, just docs. Ebooks, you guessed it, ebooks. Pictures for graphics and photos. And if I ever get to the point where I have so many photos that I need to separate them out, I'll probably make like a graphics folder and a photos folder or something like that. Sites, websites that I'm building, SRC, source code that I've downloaded from other people, and then vids, which is video files and projects that I'm working on. That tends to suit me a lot better, that kind of structure for my home folder. It's one of those things that, again, I've kind of noticed other people when I'm working on their system, showing them something, and I'll create like a bin file or a code file or a source file or some file outside of their predefined structure, and their eyes get big, and they're like, you can't do that, can you? Yeah, you can. It's your home. You can do whatever you want to. You can make it work better for you. And so that's, I guess, the rant, I guess, that this is. I mean, it's not really a rant because I don't care how other people build their systems and maintain it, but I just felt like it was something worth noting that, you know, if you've just installed Fedora or some other OS that kind of does a lot of pre-building and pre-setting up for you, keep in mind that you don't necessarily have to keep all of those presets that they've given you. There may be good starting points or there may be good ideas, but you don't have to have only 6 folders or whatever it is in your home directory. You can have lots if you want. You can make categories that work better for you. You don't have to go into music and then make an audio file, a folder for your audio stuff and your albums music for the stuff that you actually listen to and your sound effects stuff that you're using for your podcasts or audio drama production, and then a podcasts folder inside of that. That's backwards categorization, right? Because you've got music leading to non-musical things. Break those things out of the music folder, ditch the music folder, and keep your data the way that you'd like to keep it. And doing that, I find, makes the backing up process a little bit easier. Because again, like podcasts, that's still something that I've been downloading straight into my home directory. But I would never want to back those up. I don't need to back them up. The internet has backed them up for me. And besides, I'm going to delete them right after I listen to them. Having the podcast folder out in the open in my home directory rather than nested in like a music folder or something makes a lot more sense, because I can just exclude that in my excludes file or whatever I need to do, and it never gets backed up. Some thoughts again about how we're organizing our data and making it maybe easier to find stuff, as well as easier to back up and exclude and not know what you know what not to back up and what actually is data that you care about. Okay, so let's go on to the next topic. And the next topic is one that I've kind of been noticing lately. And it's a bit of a realization, really. And it's probably really obvious, actually. But for me, it kind of it got hit home, as they say. And that is that one size does not fit all when it comes to the concept of killer features. So there's a lot of times that people will say, well, what's a killer feature of this desktop, or what's a killer feature of this operating system, or whatever? And you look for those things. You look for those killer features, and kind of the definition of a killer feature is, well, it does this thing which nothing else does. And eventually, if you go deep enough into some other solution, you realize, well, actually, it does that too. It just might not do it the same way. And so the killer feature is probably not as unique. I mean, what better episode to talk about this than the one that I just talked about, Jonathan's feedback to me, where I thought that KDE was the only file manager that could move files, and it turns out that every file manager on Earth can move files. So, perfect case in point. In other words, there's no such thing as a killer feature, very nearly. And you can argue that point because, of course, there are killer features. I mean, I could list some things that some text editor does not do that my text editor does. You know, There are also, obviously, yes, there are killer features. But in another sense, there are no killer features, because each of us have different definitions of what a killer feature would be. And here's my illustration of that. I was helping someone with some internet stuff, like uploading files to the web server, editing them, uploading them, seeing the page design live on the internet. And this was something that we were doing on his computer that was not Linux. And this is a friend that I go back and forth with on Linux, in a good way. I mean, it's not competitive or anything, but he's got a VM with Linux installed, so it exists on his computer, but it's not the thing that he boots into. And of course, it's been my experience so far that if you're that kind of user, where you're like, yeah, Linux is cool, it's really cool, I support it, thumbs up, yeah, it's really neat, I've even got a VM of it on my computer, then you might also be the kind of user who rarely opens Linux. You know, it's just, there's got to be some reason to go to the trouble of opening up that VM and kind of being in that operating environment. Because otherwise you're going to default to what you know. And you're just going to default to the thing that the computer boots into, because that's why you're booting into that environment. It's difficult, I think, to find a reason to double-click on that VM application and bring up Linux and actually use it. Anyway, with my friend, that's been the case. So whenever I sit down with him and we talk about these web tasks that he keeps asking me about, every time we sit down, you know, we'll start out and we'll be in his OS, and then I'll say, look, since I'm sitting right here, let's switch over to Linux. I know that a lot better, and this will give you a chance to use it. So we do. We open up the VM and we use the Linux operating system for these tasks. So finally, recently, at one point, I decided he was ready for the big reveal. This is GNOME 3, and I said, look, here's a cool way, here's something really neat. Rather than FTPing into the server, grabbing the file to your local hard drive, modifying it, loading it back into the FTP application, and uploading it to the server, let's just log on to the server. So I showed him the trick in Nautilus where you can go to the Go menu, go to location, type in your server name, and log in with, you know, SSHFS or whatever it's called, and there are the files on your server in a graphical view, as if though they were right on your computer. You can even right-click on it and open it in your native local text editor such as gedit. You should have seen the guy's face when this happened. I mean, it was like he'd seen the face of God. It was beautiful. I mean, it was the very definition of a killer feature. I mean, first of all, he saw the server, right? All these files that had previously been nothing but little lines of text in his fairly generic FTP program, or worse yet, blobs of text in a terminal that completely seemed foreign to him. Now they were files that looked exactly like the rest of his files. And then to be able to right-click on one and actually open it in a little text editor right there to make the changes, hit save, open up Firefox, hit refresh, and there's the change he just made. It was as if, though, I had redefined the internet for him. And in a way, I had. You know, I mean, he, for the first time, understood the files on that server were no different than the files on his computer, and that there was really no separation. When you're networking, it can be all one big computer, to steal the tagline from Sun Microsystems. So that was a killer feature. And admittedly, that's kind of one of the killer features for me too. I mean, on Linux, that kind of network transparency is a big deal, and it is quite unique. It's not completely unique, obviously. There are ways to get there on other operating systems, but the level of network transparency and the way that it works, and with so many different protocols, that's a big deal. And this was a big killer feature for him, and it was one that I would have never imagined. I was trying to pitch all different kinds of things, like, look at this cool little photo editor. It's shot well, and it's exactly like your other one on your other operating system, or it's quite like it. And here's how you do all these tasks. And, you know, I was trying to sell him on these different things, and the one that clinched the deal was SSHFS, or whatever it's called. So it was really kind of an eye-opening experience for me, because I was realizing that one person's killer feature isn't another person's killer feature. Another quicker example would be just one time I was doing something on a computer at work, and I happened to double-click my title bar in Dolphin, and I have it set such that they do the whole window shade thing. That's what I like to do when I double-click on my title bar. And the person had apparently never seen that before on any OS. That was something completely new. Really, really impressed her. And again, I would have never thought that would be the one thing that would impress the person about my Linux desktop, you know? So it's always something. And I think the point that I'm trying to make, I guess, is to enter into your discussions with that in mind. You might have some preconceived notions of what this person might really, really like about what you're about to show them. But don't be closed off to the possibility that you may have no idea what's going to impress them, and they're going to latch onto something. And if they do, I guess capitalize on that. I sound like I'm telling you how to, like, make a sale in the field or something, or make a kill on the battlefield. But yeah, capitalize on that. When you detect the whole killer feature alarm, don't ignore it. Zero in on it and take advantage of it, you know? Show it to them again. Ask them, wouldn't you like to have that feature on your operating system? Wouldn't you like to switch to Linux now? Not really, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, recognize the fact that killer features aren't the same for everyone. And for that matter, neither are the things that you love on Linux. For years, I've been thinking KDE was just the best thing ever, and that it can be everything for everyone. And that's correct, it's true, but it's also not quite true, because, as I've said before, you can't explain away the fact that no one ever blinks or looks twice at my KDE desktops at work, and yet every single time I've been using GNOME 3, people have actually out of the blue commented on it, as if though it was the first time they've noticed that I wasn't running the same operating system that they were. I don't know why. It's just, that's how it is. So look out for those killer features. Recognize that they're not the same for everyone. And be careful out there. You might convert someone to Linux. Okay, one last topic. I actually went on a little bit longer in some of the topics than I meant to, so we're right up against the end here. But I did want to mention this before next time anyway. Because, I don't know, it's sort of interesting. So, multilingual support on the Linux desktop. It's really, really easy, actually. And I know that in a much earlier season, way back when, I did a little tutorial on how to mess around with Xmod map so that you could do, like, non-standard characters on your keyboard. So, like, if you wanted an E with an accent mark over it or whatever, you could do an Xmod map so that your compose key is, I think is what it's called, or a dead letter key or something like that. You hit that, the apostrophe, and then you hit E, and suddenly you've got E with an accent mark over it. So that's really handy, and it's been working really well for me, but I was actually setting up a Fedora system on a netbook for a friend of mine who actually so far has not been complaining at running Linux and plans to build a desktop with Linux on it very soon. But anyway, I was setting this system up, and he was moving to Argentina, so he decided to have his keyboard layout be multilingual. I'd never done that before. I always did it with Xmodmap, so watching him configure it, believe it or not, he figured out how to configure it himself. That was kind of cool, too. Was really enlightening to me, and I've kind of fallen into doing it this way if I'm not in, if I am in the GUI. This was really interesting way of doing things, I thought. So there are two or three different aspects of multilingualism on a GUI Linux desktop. Number one, and I guess even GUI-less, I mean, for this first one, number one is the locale. That's the language that you want your system to talk to you in. So if there are locale files to an application, then when you open an application, that's the language it's going to present to you for the menu items and the menus themselves and notifications and things like that, at least to the extent that they have translations. So that's the locale. And the typical one that you would see for yourself, usually if you're listening to this show and you're in America or England or Australia, then it would be something like EN underscore, US for here, or UK for in England, stuff like that. Or GR, actually, great. Or GB, I don't know. EN underscore something. For France, it would be FR. That's the locale. That can be set in your GUI in System Settings, whether you're running KDE or GNOME 3, it doesn't matter. Just go to System Settings, and there's a place in KDE called, I think, Locale, and a place in GNOME 3 called Region and Location, or something like that. So that the locale you would switch from, I mean, you don't have to switch, you can set, and that can be the way that you interface with your computer. That's pretty simple. The next thing you want to do is set the keyboard layout. Now that defines what character is going to appear on your screen when you hit a certain key on your keyboard. Makes sense. The primary one that you would want to run on your system, obviously, would be whatever keyboard you have, probably. So I bought this computer in the US market. Actually, I traded it with someone, but anyway, the point was that it came from, it was destined for the U.S. market, so it's got a very standard keyboard for the USA. And for, for the USA, because it's got the dollar sign and everything, so it's very localized for me. So that is the one that I'm using as my primary layout. But if you want to be able to switch to another one to get characters that aren't part of the English alphabet, then you can do that. And it, again, in KDE and GNOME, it's pretty similar. You go to System Settings, and in KDE, it's in the Input Devices, under Keyboard. And then in GNOME 3, it's under, I think, again, it's the Location and Region one. Top row of System Settings. I'm not sitting in front of GNOME 3 right now, but it's something like that. Region and Location, I think. You can set the primary and even like a secondary or a tertiary keyboard layout that you want to use. So for me, for instance, I might set a secondary Esperanto layout. Now, the cool thing about this is that you can switch back and forth at any given moment between those two keyboard layouts, meaning that if you want to have some kind of hotkey assigned to your layout, or to be a toggle between layouts, you can do that. Again, it's in the same place, both in KDE and GNOME. You're still in this Input Devices menu on KDE in System Settings, or in the Region and Location control panel in GNOME 3, and there's a menu that's actually really similar on both. They might even be the same. And it gives you the option of using something to toggle keyboard layouts. I have it set on my system to be Alt Space. So if I hit Alt Space, then my indicator up in my little taskbar thing switches from US to EO. and now I know that I'm in my Esperanto layout. Kai mi type W, then I get G, or the Gis key, whatever, G with a little house top over it, or an acute, I guess, is what it would be. So it's really great for if you roughly know the layout of some other language and you want access to all those special characters, but you don't want to have to deal with that all the time, because I find that if you just switch over to, like, the Esperanto keyboard or something, or Spanish or German, whatever, then, yeah, sure, or, well, actually, for sure, the French one, for instance, sure, you get these extra characters built in, and you might be able to remember where they are, but then weird things like the at symbol is no longer where you think it is, so you have to search for that, and that gets a little bit complex. So being able to switch over just temporarily, hitting the key that you want, and then switch back with the alt space, now you're back on your English layout, and you're typing away as if though nothing had ever changed. So that's the way that I've seen real live multilingual people deal with their multilingualism. And a last dear listener, that is the end of the show. So hopefully you've enjoyed the show as well as your coffee, and please feel free to find me online in various forums. Mostly IRC is good. I'm on freenode.net there in the Ogcast Planet channel. Also the Slacker Media channel if you need support for Slacker Media. You can IM me at notclatu@jabber.org. And you can email me at notclatu@hackerpublicradio.org, I think. Maybe it's Clatu. I think it's clatu@hackerpublicradio.org or clatu@member.fsf.org. And of course the website itself is GNUWorldOrder.info. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Sorry, I can't.